Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tristan Hallman. Co-hosting this week is our criminal courts reporter, Sarah Mervosh.
Hey, Tristan.
And my fellow police reporter, Naomi Martin.
Hey.
Today we'll talk about Dallas County District Attorney Susan Hawke and police use of force. Editorial writer Mike Hashimoto will end our show with his latest hashing it out about Dallas Cowboy Greg Hardy. We'll also talk by phone this week with Austin American Statesman reporter Jasmine Ulloa. We will talk to her about the trial of a man who killed four people at South by Southwest last year by driving his car into a crowd. But first, let's start with Susan Hawke. Sarah, when we first started doing this show, Susan Hawke couldn't be found at the courthouse. We weren't sure if and when we would see her again. Now she's involved in a relatively low-profile murder case. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so over the summer, our district attorney here disappeared on the job. No one knew where she was, and it later came out that she had been seeking treatment at a psychiatric hospital for depression treatment. And so she recently returned to work last month, and so now she's facing a lawsuit to remove her from office, but she's trying to reestablish herself. And one of the ways that she's doing that is by a town hall earlier this week with the public. That was her first since returning from depression treatment. And then the next morning, she showed up in court for jury selection of a very sort of routine, standard murder case. And we can listen to her introduce herself to the jurors here.
So my name is Susan Hawke, and I am your elected district attorney. And I'm going to be talking to you during jury selection today. And so did everyone have a nice lunch? Okay. So I get the opportunity to talk to you after you have full belly. So I hope no one falls asleep here during jury selection. But this is the only time that I get to talk to you, that the lawyers get to talk to you about the facts in the case.
And so she actually, after that, she did make a point to say, there's no magical or special reason that I'm down here on this case. You shouldn't think anything about the case because of it. But I just think that leadership starts at the top and I should be able to come in and try any case that I want. And so here she is trying a relatively standard murder case this week.
I almost expected to hear one of the jurors pop up like Monty Python. I didn't vote for her when she mentions the elected district attorney. How rare is it, though, for a district attorney in a county the size of Dallas to actually try a case?
Well, there's been some debate about that. I mean, it is quite rare. I mean, it's a large county and, you know, the job is administrative. They are not down there trying cases every day. That's for sure. But some people have taken issue with, you know, us calling it unusual because they said, well, you know, her predecessor, Craig Watkins, he helped out on a capital murder death penalty case. Or his predecessor, Bill Hill, he helped on another like really high profile case. But the difference here and sort of the nuance of it is that those were high profile cases. This is a murder, domestic violence murder case that maybe otherwise might not have gotten much attention.
And it does it sort of reestablish her, help burnish her image after everything that happened with her disappearing and going off to rehab?
Well, she's certainly trying to reestablish herself and build up her credibility because she's trying to show that she's competent in court and is able to prosecute a case. And it was interesting because her mom came to listen to testimony partial this week. And then her friend and political advisor, Mary Woodleaf, was also there, sort of, I think, just sort of making sure everything went smoothly. So I don't think there's any debating that this is part of her attempt to reestablish her credibility after being gone.
Is she actually questioning witnesses and stuff?
Yeah, she made jury selection on Tuesday, and then she on Wednesday she made the opening statements for the state, and then she did question some witnesses.
And what has she been like to you?
I mean, she was a former prosecutor for many years. She was a former state district judge. She has a command of the courtroom. You know, she's stopping witnesses when they go on too far. She's comforting them, asking if they're okay when they're crying. She's demanding justice to the jury. So she has a command of the courtroom. And it's sort of interesting. You know, she's the elected district attorney, but she's the second chair. And so one of her employees is lead prosecutor. And then she's, you know, she say, may I approach Your Honor to the bench and to a judge? You know, it's just like a very interesting dynamic about who's really, you know, the most powerful person in the courtroom.
Yeah, talk about having your boss look over your shoulder.
I know. Micromanaging. I don't know.
Well, how long will the case go and how long will she be in court?
It'll probably go through this week. You know, you never know with court cases, but the defense. So I should mention that Quavez, I think that's how you pronounce his first name, Quavez Jones, is accused of killing Marietta Shaw, his girlfriend, stabbing her 39 times last year. So he's on trial for murder and faces up to life in prison. The defense has not offered a very rigorous defense yet, although they're scheduled to go still. They've basically implied that it could have been self-defense or a sudden passion, which comes with a lesser sentence, but they haven't outright denied his involvement.
Well, we're certainly looking forward to seeing how that plays out. Thank you very much, Sarah.
You're welcome.
So there's been a lot of talk the last 2 years about police use of force, and Dallas police have tried to change their training to accommodate more of a time and distance and de-escalation effort into their reality scenario training and increase the amount of training. Naomi, you and I yesterday went over to the place where they train, which is the Lamar School. So it's an old school building that doesn't even have air conditioning or central air in a lot of the rooms. What'd you think?
It was really scary. So Tristan and I had to get all suited up. First, we observed a few of the cops doing their typical training, and then he and I, you know, got the opportunity to do it ourselves, I think because they wanted to laugh at us. But anyways, we got suited up in this armor, you know, our neck covered, helmets, masks on, groin protection, and we got, you know, a gun belt with a gun on one side and a taser
on the other.
Real guns, but they shot like paint bullets.
They were fitted to only shoot 7mm bullets with a plastic tip that shoots like a cosmetic marker. So
okay.
So basically, you get hit.
They trust you with guns? That's a little scary.
They shouldn't have. Yeah.
They really shouldn't have. But so we, you know, Tristan and I are pretending to be like cop partners, and we're in this like a, you know, vacant school building, and an officer who's an actor, and he's pretending to be a suspect that we're trying to talk to, and we're in like a weird alley thing that we're trying to imagine, and basically he has a knife that we can see. He's holding it to his throat, and he's like
in the first scenario,
and
so he's threatening to kill himself.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and it's just one of those situations where, you know, officers have to quickly think: is this guy a threat to me? Is he a threat to himself? If he's a threat to himself, you know, that's not a reason to use force. But if he's a threat to you, then you can use force. And so it was an interesting and scary exercise to try to figure out whether you tase someone who's coming at you, or whether you shoot them, or whether you run away like I wanted to, but cops can't. What did you think, Tristan?
Well, they didn't have it at a very realistic speed for us. Obviously, we don't have full police training going in, but it was a pretty basic scenario. And, you know, it really does get stressful, even though you are in what you know is fake. You know, we did a shoot, don't shoot simulation with just a video board, and that was stressful too. So, but even,
right.
even when
it's like, you know, it's fake, but your adrenaline goes up, your heart's pounding. I was like shaking.
Well, we also had all the cops around us watching us
and like filming us on their iPhone.
Our sound engineer, Tommy Noel, was actually there filming us. And Tommy, how stupid did we look while we were doing it?
You didn't look stupid. I thought you looked kind of cool, you know, with all the protection and the gear and stuff. But something that I wanted
to
bring up.
We pay him to say that.
No. I'm being serious. I remember when one of the officers asked you if you wanted to do this, and you both had a look of, yes, I want to, but no, I don't want to at the exact same time. It was a very interesting look that y'all had when they were offered to do it.
You weren't going in. You were just going to watch, and then they offered you
to
do it.
Yeah, I'm doing a story, and Tristan's doing other stories about, you know, use of force and their training, and this training, they're trying to ramp it up a lot, and they're actually looking for fundraising right now to get, like, a mini fake city that they can do more of this on with, like, a...
So they don't have to play pretend as much in a school building.
Yeah.
You know, this would be really interesting, though. I wonder if they could do something with community relations and improving relationship with the police if they brought in, like, classes or people from the community to simulate it, like, themselves, like, people from areas of the city that maybe don't trust police, to show them, like, here's how we decide, or here's how hard it is to decide. I mean, that could be interesting.
It's really hard. And like I said, they were going at half speed, and all of these, even though that was a pretty basic scenario, and it's just, you know, they ran us through it three times with the guy doing three different things, and we obviously knew it was coming each time because we'd already witnessed it. But all of these were supposed to be based on things that actually happened.
Right. They like go through the news and look at like viral incidents, and then they reenact them. Like there was one in Arlington where it was a domestic incident. The cops get there to talk to the woman, and while the cop is in there,
she's in the doorway.
And the suspect came back, the man, and shot her and the woman. The cop ended up saving a kid's life, but the cop was killed. So they do that scenario. They do the other Arlington scenario that made a lot of news. They do, you know, all these incidents that you see, you know, viral on the internet. They reenact those to try to figure out how can we do this more peacefully without ending a life or without, you know, using force at all, if there's a way to do that.
And for as many variables as they try to throw at them like that, you still don't control for every situation that you go into. And experience is often the best teacher, but they are human, and sometimes they make mistakes, as we've seen, you know, a few times. It's not always malicious. I'm not saying every incident isn't. I don't know if, you know, what's in their head, but for the most part, it seems like in their head, they're thinking, they're just trying to do what's best, and they're just hoping the muscle memory kicks in, and that's why they're trying to increase the training.
Oh, and one thing I found really hard about it was switching from a taser to a gun or gun to a taser. I mean,
you just choose the wrong one. You know, and people be deadly.
Well, you don't
that
really
happened in Oklahoma.
Yeah, it is harder to choose the wrong one just because they're on different sides of you. And I assume that once you've had a lot more training than me, you do get used to which one is on which side. But like the holstering part of it, and you have to make sure it's holstered before you get the other one, and all that stuff takes like precious time when you don't really have it. And I think a lot of people after these shootings always ask, well, they could have tased him. Why didn't they just tase him? But in the heat of the moment, it's so hard to switch between them. So if you already have your gun out, you know, or if you have your taser out and you try to hesitate, that could mean your life. And I think, you know, that's something that I didn't really appreciate how long it takes to switch until yesterday.
And they also, with those belts, they don't just have a gun and a taser. They have a baton. They have OC spray, which is mace. So they have a lot of options available to them. And we did go in cold. We don't have to wear these belts on a daily basis. So that's what they were saying. Muscle memory kicks in. That's why the training is so important.
But do all cops get this training, or is it only particular ones?
They are trying to do it once a year for patrol, and for people, and once a quarter for specialized units like SWAT, and sort of units that have to deal a lot with dangerous suspects. Narcotics, for instance, is often going into making dynamic entries into houses, and you don't know who exactly is in there. You're dealing with not very much information every time you walk in somewhere. But people who are doing desk jobs once every 2 years. Now joining us on the line is Jasmine Ulloa, who is a courts reporter for the Austin American Statesman. Jasmine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You were last week, you were covering the trial of Rashad Owens, who was accused of killing four people, is that right, at the South by Southwest Festival in 2014?
Sure, yes. He was accused of killing four people and injuring more than 20 others.
So what was that trial like covering for you? Obviously, it's one of the big, I mean, you don't hear often of huge murder cases coming out of Austin.
Particularly at a festival that many people across the state attend.
Right. So what was that like covering for you?
It was definitely one of the biggest cases I've covered. It was the biggest trial of the year. It was a very hard trial to cover because all 4 days of testimony were so full of emotion, so full of vivid and graphic images. And of course, you know, South By, it's a festival a lot of people love in Austin. I love it. I was there that night, so it brought back a lot of memories. I didn't help cover the case right when it broke, but I've just been thinking about this case a lot recently, just because it was a difficult one to cover.
What were you doing that night? Like, do you remember, like, did you hear the crash?
No. So, and to clarify, I had left an hour or two before it actually happened, but I was in that area. I was walking around 7th Street and Red River. So when I woke up the next day and saw the news, I was supposed to be off, and I checked Twitter the first thing in the morning and I saw what had happened. I knew there, you know, I had to go into the office immediately. So
what was Rashad Owens' sort of demeanor in court, and what was his defense for what happened?
Prosecutors had to prove Rashad intentionally or knowingly committed actions dangerous to human life. So while prosecutors focused on the second part of that charge, showing that Rashad knew fleeing from police was dangerous, that he knew fleeing at whatever the cost was dangerous, defense lawyers attempted to keep the focus on his intent. Did he mean to kill anybody? And his defense lawyers argued he didn't. They described him as a young rapper from the small town of Killeen with hopes and dreams to make it big in the music business. You know, he was 21 at the time and working at Little Caesars. He was the father of six kids. or he is the father of six kids, and so they said he was scared and drunk and disoriented when he drove into those crowds on Red River.
But Jasmine, the key point, it seems like, is that he accelerated into the crowd. Is that right? Because, you know, you don't often hear about, you know, drunk driving cases turning into capital murder. Typically, they get off as manslaughter.
Right. And so, I think that was a big question for prosecutors, why this case needed to go to trial, is that prosecutors didn't feel that it was a case about drunken driving. They felt it was a case about a young man who took selfish actions, who knew what he was doing, who was well aware that he was taking selfish actions.
And did he testify?
He didn't testify.
And that's his right to plead the Fifth. He does not have to testify, and jurors can't hold that against him.
Right. So the most we got from Rashad was his words in those videos, in those dash cam videos, after he was arrested, where at first he was screaming for help and asking that his handcuffs be loosened, and then later you kind of see him go through these stages of shock and realization, I guess, or just confrontation with what he's done. He's praying in the car, saying the Lord's Prayer. So I think that was very tense for everyone in the courtroom to hear.
Did defense attorneys explain at all why he might have accelerated? Because, you know, you can be, if you're drunk driving, there's, you know, anyone might know that drunk driving could be lethal to someone else. But did they explain why he accelerated into the crowd? I mean, fleeing the police is one thing, but then driving faster into the crowd is another.
Yes, I think their big point was this all happened in the span of 5 seconds. I mean, when he turned onto Red River, which they said was partially blocked, and if you're a guy from Killeen, probably aren't used to driving in downtown Austin when there's these big festivals and marathons when streets are always closed. So they argued, and this was their argument, that this whole crash happened in a matter of 5 seconds. So he had very little time to perceive and react.
So
whether
there
that's
were,
true.
Yeah.
That was up to the jury to decide.
And obviously they decided he was guilty.
We should add, I don't know, we've mentioned that he was found guilty of capital murder and now has an automatic life sentence in prison.
Yes.
So for listening to the injured victims, there were more than 20. I'm sure some of them testified. Is that right?
Yes.
What was that experience? Because, you know, you hear about the four dead, and that's obviously what he was on trial for. But there are, you know, two dozen others who were victimized by him and have to live with what they thought was just going to a festival, and ended up getting, you know, run down by a car.
Yes. And like I said, I mean, that was especially hard to hear of the recovery. Witnesses described a very chaotic scene that night. They described what looked like a war zone, a street where a tornado had blown through. And then that, coupled with the images that the prosecutor showed in the coming days, there was a videographer there filming for Spin magazine. He happened to be on the street, and he just caught, you know, all these bodies lying on the floor, people trying to help strangers. It was just very emotional to be there, I think.
Jasmine, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it, and we'll stay tuned to your coverage in the Austin American Statesman. Obviously, your paper's covering the Travis County judge who was shot, so we look forward to hearing more about that as well. But thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all for today's show. Mike Hashimoto has a new Hashing It Out next. But before we go, remember that you can follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crimecast. You can also like us on Facebook. You can hear more about all the stories you heard today on DallasNews.com or read more about them. Thanks for listening. And remember that we have a new episode out every Thursday. We are on iTunes. Thanks to our producer today, Tommy Noel. For Sarah Mervosh and Naomi Martin, I'm Tristan Hallman. We hope you stay safe out there. Please don't point laser beams at airplanes. And now we drop the mic.
If the topic is crime and the subject is Greg Hardy, you have a legitimate question. What crime? As the Dallas Cowboys pass rusher now points out, he's innocent until proven guilty. So ignore for the moment his recent attempt at contrition. What you need to know is this. A judge may have found that Hardy beat a woman half his size and threw her onto a futon covered with rifles. As far as the law goes, it never happened. He appealed, she couldn't be found, and his lawyers had the conviction tossed. Free and clear. So every knucklehead, goofball thing Greg Hardy does going forward means what exactly? Stupid comments about players' wives, slapping a clipboard from a coach's hands, dumb tweets. None of that matters, right? Because Hardy is an exceptional football player. It has been that way his entire life. Why should today be any different? He's certainly not the first miscreant to cash a Jerry Jones paycheck. Why single him out? Cowboys fan, NFL fan, sports fan, this is what it takes to win. If you don't like it, change the channel. Because until you do, this is the way things will always be.